What you know about layer 1 D5, greatest in the world, and they finally about to see why. What you know about XRD, I'm smart money, I ain't never on a decline. What you know about NFTs, it's not just ace, when you finally gonna realize. You need scalability, need more utility, then you better call on these guys. I'm going radical, I'm going radish, I'm going radical, I'm going radish. Hyperspeed D5, never on a decline, building the future, I feel like a savage.
Hello and welcome. I am Piers Ridyard, CEO of RDX Works, core developer of the decentralized finance protocol Radix, a public ledger entirely focused on bringing DeFi into the mainstream. This is our podcast, The DeFi Download, a show about decentralized finance and all things crypto, where we dive into the details of the projects, assets, and services that are powering the DeFi revolution. Today, I'm joined by Lane Castleman, president of Blockchain.com. Blockchain.com is a crypto wallet exchange and institutional offering that together makes it the world's most popular destination to buy, sell, and trade crypto for consumers and businesses. Lane, so good to have you on the show.
Piers, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here and have a chance to chat today. We've been trying to get this on the books for a few months, so I'm glad we're doing it.
It's been an interesting, like the last time we spoke.
3 or 4 months or something. Yeah, I feel like it's been a while.
I mean, to be fair, you have a good excuse though, because I feel like, you know, congratulations are in order. You are now president of Blockchain.com, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
I hear under your supervision, Blockchain.com has grown quite a bit since you joined.
Yeah, I mean, you know, of course, like most things, and you know, as a CEO, you're not the sole person responsible, but you help lead a team that's responsible. But we've grown quite a bit since I joined about 2 years ago, over 5x, and
wow.
It feels pretty cool to see the company, you know, transition so dramatically.
So over 5x, and so what, like, I was talking before with one of your team and sort of Blockchain.com, its offerings have expanded quite a lot, right? It's sort of much more of a multi-services platform for individuals and users and businesses as well. So, like, how would you describe Blockchain.com and who the ideal person who should be coming to your platform and using it is?
Yeah, that's what's so amazing about the company, and I think why our employees are so sticky and why our customers are too. It truly is a crypto finance house, or, you know, a traditional, it's mirrored with a traditional financial institution, because we're able to serve consumers in a lot of different ways. And we can talk about that, but also institutional clients in a lot of different ways. And, you know, there's many companies that work to serve one or the other and maybe have a little bit of an offering that, you know, kind of serves the professional financial services organization. Or sort of the resale class, but they sort of dabble in the other one. We really do both in a very meaningful way, which makes it so interesting. It is a bit built like Amazon in that sense. We don't offer books and TV shows and that kind of thing. But we do have many different products and services that are built on the common infrastructure and platform, which is, you know, a bit different than I think a lot of startups in the Web3 space.
I mean, the main thing it started as, if I remember correctly, Blockchain.com was a wallet, right? I think it was the first wallet that a lot of people who were in the early days of crypto, early crypto, when was it founded?
Yeah, so Blockchain actually this month will, well, it depends on what date you sort of demarcate the start of the company. But if you do it from the incorporation, it'll be 11 years old.
11 years.
Later this month.
Yeah.
Which makes it one of the oldest companies in crypto, right?
Right.
Our founders like to joke that they're the crypto grandpas, Peter and Nick.
Right.
They've been in crypto for so long. And you know, if they incorporated 11 years ago, they were working on this 13 years ago, right? So it's been a long time. You're right. Blockchain.com had one of the first wallets, but actually even before that, it was known as blockchain.info. And it had an explorer, right?
Yeah.
Which was the original search engine for crypto. And that's what put it on the map. That's where everyone knew it. And just like, you know, typical, very nerdy engineers, they bought both domains and thought, why on earth would we want to call it blockchain.com? It's blockchain.info because it's an explorer. So it's info. And then it wasn't until many years later that they hired some marketing professionals who said, no. Actually, you own this other domain, which is much
more
valuable.
That's a better domain. Let's use that one. Our Radix was the same. Radix was the same. Radix was radix.global.
Yeah.
Because it's global. Exactly. Like.
Yeah. Which is, I mean, you can't argue with the logic, like it makes sense, but
yeah
for marketing and SEO. Anyway, so, but you're right. One of the first wallets, you know, you probably remember back in the early days, you know, it was hard to even find a place to buy crypto, much less store it somewhere. Right. And so know, blockchain really benefited from early adoption in London, where it was founded, and throughout Western Europe, where people were, you know, I think a little bit more finance forward than they are in other parts of the world. And crypto adoption happened faster, or at least initially happened faster. Mm. So blockchain really became that place to store your crypto.
But like, I think that just saying, oh, we were early in the space and you know, just built something that people, that undersells it, right? There was plenty of companies that I remember who did wallets who aren't around anymore, who like did web wallets and were like very popular, right? You know, yeah. If you go back through the internet archives and look in 2012, 2013, 2014 for like, what is the best Bitcoin wallet? And like, you'll see blockchain.com as one of the options, but you'll also see like a bunch that you'll, you know, haven't heard of and it sort of disappears. So like, what was different about the DNA of blockchain.com? What did you guys do differently?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the fundamental offerings of our wallet is that it's not custodial. And I think, you know, this is, so it's funny, like today, most consumers don't, well, it depends on where you are in the world. But a lot of consumers don't necessarily think about custodial versus non-custodial. They think about the crypto company that they've seen marketing and advertising for, or they get a promotion to use. And that's because if you live in the US or you live in many parts of Western Europe, your financial system is really stable. So a custodial wallet, right, which for users, although they probably all know what that is, right, is more like a bank account, right, where your funds are commingled. There's a ledger record of your assets. Mm. You know, those are, you know, come with inherent benefits, right? They can be faster in execution, but they also come with some real risk, which is, you know, if there is a hack or there's government intervention, they can access your funds. Blockchain has always been a non-custodial wallet, so more like a safe deposit box. And I think that really did appeal initially to early users in crypto who were like unsure whether government regulation was going to catch up with crypto. And so, you know, were they operating in a legally gray area or not? And then also, there were a lot of hacks, right? Everyone remembers Mt. Gox, right. And there were many others. And so it was like, how do we, you know, as an individual who holds these assets and maybe, you know, the person may have hundreds or thousands of Bitcoins that they acquired for, you know, a penny or, you know, a cent less. How do they safeguard them? And so blockchain really did offer one of those earliest solutions. And so it's proven out even in our DNA today. Now today on the retail side, we do have that non-custodial wallet, 84 million have been created, which is tremendous. And that's happened in 200 countries around the world. We also offer, you know, rewards of products or an interest product sort of in your life cycle. But then we offer an exchange and we're growing in our exchange ranking. I think we're at about the top 30 now. But the exchange is custodial, right? So like you go through the life cycle and we think once you get to that point, you actually understand the risks and benefits to having that type of product. But our core still very much is the non-custodial on the retail side.
That's interesting. So it was actually a question I was going to ask, which is that your exchange products and I would also imagine your institutional products are custodial rather than non-custodial. Does that like, yeah. how do you square the circle internally on sort of between sort of the early sort of decentralization maximalism and sort of like not your keys, not your crypto sort of basis that has created the early success for you guys and the narrative around making sure that you are owning what you think you are to sort of now offering more sort of like easy to use services both for consumers and for businesses that want to get into crypto? Like how has that felt as a narrative internally?
Yeah, I mean, what I find personally just so fascinating about the ecosystem is that what we're creating today are mirrors for BNP Paribas or Barclays or Bank of America or Wells Fargo, large multinational banks on the retail side. But nobody starts a bank today and says, like, I'm going to build the next Citibank, right? Mm-hmm. They probably start a bank with a specific purpose, like it's a neobank or maybe it's like a small regional bank. But, you know, and eventually over time it grows into that. But yet with companies like ours and some of our competitors, that's essentially what we did was we set up shop to become like a Citibank. And so what does that mean? Well, that means we have to offer products and services meeting our customers where they are. And right. So in some places, you know, for example, in Nigeria, we're the number one crypto product in Nigeria. Well, most consumers there transact with Tron, right? Because they're buying their groceries or ordering a pizza. And so we realized blockchain had this tremendous brand value in Nigeria. And the customers there weren't really transacting in Bitcoin or Ethereum, which, you know, most of the other global market is primarily but really Tron. So we went through the process to list Tron and really pretty much that product is focused there because we got to meet our customers there. Now, if you look in the US, none of our US customers are buying Tron. They don't even know what it is, right? And so, you know, in Nigeria, they're using it to buy pizza and order the groceries and pay the babysitter. In the US, it's like, hey, I want to save up for braces or a vacation. And so it's a faster way to get yield. Completely different use cases. And so blockchain today has to offer these different products and services that are even somewhat customized by region and country because we have to meet our customers where they are, and they're different in different countries and different places.
Tron being big anywhere like blows my mind. But...
Right. The banking system there is kind of unstable, untrustworthy. This is similar in Latin America, where kind of like it's the corollary to when I got married 13 years ago, all right, we spent a month in India on our honeymoon, and we were in Rajasthan, and we were out in the desert, and we had this guy who was sort of taking us through the dunes, and like he was doing everything on his like old Nokia phone, right? And he took us to his little village where he lived, and there was no wired infrastructure, but his life was run off this old Nokia. I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. I worked in telecom early in my life, like cellular or mobile jumped over the need for wired infrastructure, right? So it eliminated the problem. And crypto in many markets, not in the US, not in Switzerland, not in the UK, but in many markets, there's a really frustrated financial system, and crypto has jumped over that frustration and now has replaced it, which is amazing. We don't get to see that in the Western world, right? Like for us, it's not that real, but in those places, it's incredible.
Yeah, no, 100%. I think, you know, we've seen there's been several leaps of that type where the sort of the old technology wasn't there. I'd actually argue, interestingly, that Europe has had a leap in fintech versus the US. The US was the first to install a digital banking system, but now it's actually one of the oldest digital banking systems in the world, and so wires still have a cost to transfer between sort of users of different banks. It's very painful, which has actually led to its own sort of things like Venmo, and actually increasingly things like USDC and stuff like that being used by young people, which has created enough of a gap in the US. In Europe, we were later to digitize the banking system, but as a result, a lot of the banks are actually app-first businesses that they've been able to do that quickly. And, you know, it's costless to transfer and instantaneous to transfer money. So actually, it might be that European and those countries are later to adopt crypto because there's less of a pain there. In China, the interesting thing happened again, where it wasn't even just app first. It was that the mobile basis, no one had cards. So now you had this sort of like scan with QR code as the basis that everyone pays with everything. And so that was like its own thing, which means that China may actually be, it may be an even later adopter of mainstream crypto. Obviously, they have their own China sort of like CBDC system, but also with their banning and stuff like that, that's going to be an interesting dynamic. And I think, you know, Africa, a lot of Africa and South America seems to be where there's the biggest pain of a terrible banking system that never caught up with the existing financial system. And now you're seeing sort of leapfrogging of entire, you know, communities now actually running just on crypto. Tron still blows my mind. I'm not going to get over that.
Well, I mean, that one is a unique use case there. It's super interesting. I mean, I think in the U.S. In sort of the dawn of the industrial age, like the you can trace most of our sort of like commoditization of dumb pipes, whether it's in telecom or energy or finance, and charging for the use of those pipes back to the railroads, right? Like that's really how it all started. And the U.S. really sort of did the railroad thing right the first time because it was so big, right? And that was like the only way to move goods and services across. I think, you know, Europe benefited from the fact that like countries were a bit smaller. And so, you know, there wasn't as much of a need for that type of infrastructure. And so things were, you know, fee structures for that type of service was based on the service and not necessarily just, the distance. And so, I think it's interesting, and I'm certainly curious in your thoughts, like, you know, how does it feel being in the part of the world where you really are finance first, right? Like I feel like when I look at our customer data, our customers all across Western Europe are the first ones willing to try new products. They're definitely way more active in crypto than anyone in sort of North America. And we're always sort of trying to figure out why that is. And it really is amazing. What do you
think? I think it's the neobanks. I honestly think it's the neobanks that have the neobanks really did well in the UK and in Germany and places like that. And they started the consumer conversation of basically finance doesn't have to be crap. But as soon as you open up like the idea and competition, right? Like there's, you know, several neobanks all vying for to be the next hot thing. It also opens up comparison, and that comparison inevitably leads to journalism covering sort of like alternatives to neobanks and things like that. And because people are in that mindset of being like, oh, I don't have to bank with my current bank, they're also in a buyer mode. They're like, well, where should I be banking or what should I be doing? And I think that sort of idea of finance not just being the relationship you've had for 20 years because, you know, your mother opened a checkings account for you when you were five so that you can start, and that's where you bank and that's it. And like that idea of it being a more like an app or a service that you download and you play around with, and, you know, you can change more often and things like that. I think that's been a big part of the conversation that's prepped the ground for finance as a new technology finance as well. Matt, that's my theory. That's what I think, at least.
No, it's so funny you say that. I had lunch with some execs from a major U.S. bank, a TradFi bank, last week before, and I said to them, I was like, you know, my question was, because I use this as a talking point a lot, like there is no one U.S. bank that dominates the entire U.S. and there's no one global bank that dominates the globe. And I was like, well, why do you guys think that is? Like, why is nobody dominated? Because you certainly have the capital to do so. Why wasn't it happening? And the answer was because most consumers get a bank account with wherever their parents had a bank account, and they never leave ever. They're there forever, right? Like, you don't really think about the choice. Like, if your parents were Barclays users, yep, you're a Barclays user, and that's it. That's what you will use, and that's what your kids will use. Yep. Like, you will have all your financial products there. And I thought, that's amazing, right? That consumers around the world are so sticky. But for what reason? Like, just, there is no reason. It's just like, they are really sticky with whatever they know.
I think it's because we inherently need, when it comes to money, most people are not speculators. They are actually very conservative about their attitudes to money. I think like the crypto world is self-selecting for high risk tolerance individuals. And actually it sort of misses a lot of the understanding that the current way in which crypto is built, it is really difficult for a consumer to get comfortable with, just because of how terrifying it is. I mean, you talk about, like, I always talk about the MetaMask experience, but the MetaMask experience is the perfect example. I remember the first time I transferred through MetaMask, and I wasn't sure whether or not I'd just lost my money.
Oh, totally. We all have so many of those experiences, like trying something new in crypto, being like, so do I still have it? Can I find it? Yeah.
Right. And so I think that all of that needs to change. But here, like, let me give you a challenge to the blockchain.com model, right? And, you know, decentralized finance is very early. And so we have tended towards safe feeling consumer experiences where I feel like, you know, if I download the wallet and something goes wrong, I, you know, blockchain.com, I can go on and I can, you know, I can talk to someone. There's someone to help me. And if I want to buy or sell something on the exchange and I don't really understand it, there's customer support staff and someone will get back to me. And then you have the other end of the spectrum, which is things like Uniswap, where, you know, MetaMask is never going to help you. They're not going to get back to you. Like, and if you go on like Reddit or like Stack Overflow or Telegram, you'll probably get some snarky comments and maybe some scam invites, right? You're not going to get help. You're probably just going to get things thrown at you until, you know, you're bloody minded enough that you're working out how to do it. And then Uniswap, again, the same thing, like sort of very difficult to understand from the point of view of like, do I click this, if I do that, like I don't see an order book, I don't see like what I would expect if I've ever used an exchange before, if I've never used an exchange before, yeah, maybe I'll get it, but still the whole concept of connecting the wallet is complicated and difficult. So, you know, I understand why things like blockchain.com are absolutely growing. Do you see that sort of like centralized model that you have, you, that you guys have tended towards away from sort of the wallet is eventually going to be less successful? Do you think that those consumer experiences in things like Uniswap and Aave and stuff like that will get to the point where consumers are very happy to use decentralized exchanges and don't need to go to centralized exchanges in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, this is the topic, right? This is the question, because we're in the down market right now. And so this is the time to be investing and building and predicting what's going to happen as we come out of it. And you want to get it right. So this is a very active topic of the company. So a couple of things. Here's my crystal ball. And we should note on the call that, like, I am not crypto native, right? I didn't come from crypto. I'm a lawyer, not an engineer. I came to it later in life. I've been involved a lot longer than the 2 years I've been in blockchain, and I started working with blockchain almost a decade ago. But
when did you start getting gray hair?
I was an early. I was in the first 100 employees of Uber, so I got the gray hair then. All gray in his hat. That's actually a good example. Like I was in mobility, right? I wasn't in crypto, and so I've come to it a bit later in life, which means that I tend to push a different angle internally. So really, what we're talking about is like, are you building products and services for the people who currently have lemons because you're going to squeeze more and more out of them? Or are you going to go after the people who the new lemons, right? Like the people who haven't gotten into crypto yet. And I think you have to have a strategy for both. So what is maybe so interesting or sort of relevant for this question is there's this investor. His name is Bill Gurley. He's kind of like the oracle of modern day investing. He's at a venture firm called Benchmark, and they were early in Uber and many other places. And there, he can be controversial, but he did an interview this past weekend in which they asked multiple questions about the current market. But then they're like, "Well, what about crypto? What's the deal? What do you think?" Right? Because major sort of luminary folks always get asked this question, and he's like, "Well, I think there's only one real use case that's been proven out so far, and that's the non-custodial wallet, right?" He's like, it makes sense in some markets to be able to sort of protect your assets from the government or interference. He's like, the other ones aren't proven out yet. And I think that's largely true. Like, and he's talking about it from a consumer standpoint, right? Which is like, what's the true value proposition for regular consumers? And so when I'm like, all right, well, my first time using DeFi, using Sushi, right? I was working with some developers from a competitor that I'm friends with who were like, there was the first time using Sushi as well, or SushiSwap. And they're like, all right, let's do this together. And we spent a Sunday. It was like 4 hours. And it was like the whole, where's our money? Are we making any money? Right? We were trying to yield farm. And like, I'm again, not an engineer, but I had like super smart guys on the phone with me on a Zoom. And we're like trying to make money, right? Trying to yield farm. And it was very complicated. And I thought, well, the yield here is amazing, but I've got access to like these brilliant developers who, again, work for competitor. We have great developers too. These are guys I'm friends with. And like nobody else has that access, or very few people do. And so I think where it goes is once there are robo-advisor products, or once there are financial services products that sit on top of DeFi protocols and strategies, so that consumers, when they're using your product, whether it's blockchain or somebody else's, all they want, and for us, it's whether it's our interest product or rewards product, whatever, they just want to say, see, oh, if I put my crypto here, I can earn 4% to 20% yield. Here's the meter for risk profile. Here's how long I have to lock it up. I don't care what happens on the back end. And I think that actually will be true for most of crypto, right? Mm-hmm. So for blockchain, we are building the super wallet so that our consumers log on. This is on the retail side. And it doesn't matter whether they're using fiat to pay their rent or use their blockchain.com debit card or credit card or buy crypto or China. They can do it all in one place. And we want it to be seamless for them so that their money, regardless of the type of asset it is available all the time for use anywhere in the world for any type of product they want. That's where it needs to go, because we can't expect them to adopt what we do. We have to adapt what we do for them.
Yeah.
So I think that's where we're pointed right now. And I do think that's where this goes.
So do you think that DeFi goes mainstream, or do you think this is, you've got your super wallet strategy. Is that also including giving people access to things like Aave, things like Sushi, things like Uniswap, and an interface that makes sense?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, we have multiple different types of wallets within the wallet, and we have a DeFi wallet, and there it is far too great a technology, and there's way too many of sort of our best developers in the space focus on it right now. And so I think those, I was giving one sort of example that's easy for my lizard brain to comprehend, right? But like a robo-advisor for DeFi, yeah. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. Yeah. There are other use cases that I have not thought of again, because like, you know, I'm not the person building them. That will be the next one after the, you know, non-custodial wallet. That's like, all right, here's the true use case. Well, I mean, and we'll see it like with NFTs this holiday season, not DeFi, right? But like, you know, we've had conversations with major brands around the world that are issuing NFTs as authenticity or proof of provenance with their right. products this holiday season. And so this will be the first moment in time in which we will have like giant numbers of consumers all around the world who are inadvertently forced into crypto without even realizing right. it, right? Like right now you have to opt in, right? Right. You're going to buy like a new, maybe not you specifically, but like a consumer will buy like a new, you know, Louis Vuitton bag, or they'll get a new diamond, or they'll get a new fancy watch. Many switchy fancy watches in Switzerland. And so it'll come with a digital certificate, right? It'll come with an NFT.
Right.
That's super interesting, but that is what I'm talking about. Like it's all going that way because the other 80% have to come into crypto. How do you get them there?
Right.
And I think it's, you know, it's just a natural transition for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like through sort of value add and appealing interface, right? Like that's right. The whole consumer model is value add and appealing interface. And I think that's what crypto has lacked entirely. Up to this point, like, you know, you look at things like Curve and how they've literally designed it to be almost, it's almost like its own internal language of what's going on in it. For you to, you have to have been, you have to be an insider to even like understand what's going on in the interface, what you need to do. So I think there's a big curve to come along. The other big topic that sort of is hot right now is regulation. So if that's where we're going, right, and we're building better interfaces towards services on top of public ledgers, which are essentially capital markets that provide yield, that provide liquidity opportunities, that provide borrowing and lending, that then can be packaged up into consumer friendly products. Where does regulation sit in that?
Yeah. So two points to start with that are, you know, super important for your fan base, you know, listening and watching to know. One is regulation in crypto is absolutely critical. Permanent regulatory frameworks are absolutely critical, and I'll explain why. That's point one. Point two is you're not going to like it, right? So those two things are at odds with each other, but they are very true. You know, we've seen this happen in sort of innovation markets over the past 15 years.
I'm really enjoying that just from the context of you being in the first 100 employees of Uber as well, because
exactly. Well, this is where it comes from, right? Like, and back then, we, you know, the idea was ask for forgiveness, right? Anybody who's like, you know, works in tech or paid attention or I guess watched the Uber TV show gets that, like, that was the idea, right? Like, we're going to do whatever we want. We're going to get in trouble. We know that. But we'll just like, get ourselves out of trouble. We'll buy ourselves out of the trouble. And regulators were caught off guard by this. And so for the most part, the punishments are pretty light. You know, you get cease and desist. This is at Uber. Cease and desist letters or some fines. But like, it was never a big deal. And the regulations were forced to rapidly change.
Right.
Because what happened was consumers adopted ride sharing around the world so fast. Regulators were like, oh my gosh, I have no choice but to regulate this right now. Because I want them to work within a framework. I want it to be safe. I want to protect consumers. But I don't have a choice to say yes or no anymore. Because, you know, and this was Uber's power. This is what we did. We'd have millions of people yelling at the regulators saying like, make it legal now, right? Had no choice, right? We gave them no choice. You can't do that anymore. Like they've gotten smart. So, so now it is an ask for permission market. And it really is up to regulators right now all over the world to decide, is crypto going to be permitted or is it not? Right. Now, in some places in the world, they don't have the ability to make it illegal. So for example, there's a lot of debate about like, you know, what happens in the US? The federal government in the US cannot make crypto illegal, right? Now they can have some, you know, strong regulation around it, but it's not like it's going to get banned. That's
why do you think that? Like, what's the knockout blow for the American regulator or the American government to never make crypto illegal?
Well, because crypto is synonymous with finance, right? And like finance means a million different things, and so does crypto. And so the US has never in its history said like all things in this category are illegal. It just doesn't, the regulatory structure doesn't work like that, because laws are very clearly divided between the federal government and the state governments. And so mm-hmm. there's no way to really, with the exception of a couple of different categories of things, for the most part, banking law or finance law is the domain of the states, right? And the federal government has securities law, but like, you know, as you know, crypto fits into those different buckets very, very differently. And so it's, you know, incumbent on those regulators to create regulation. Now, and this is happening in the EU right now. They're, I think, probably a little bit behind the US in their development of policy, but this is what MiCA is about. And we've seen, you know, regulatory frameworks created in Germany, created in France, in Italy, and multiple markets around Europe. And there's a registration process at the FCA in the UK.
Which is terrible, by the way. That has been an absolute travesty, that whole FCA regulation.
We're all hopeful it gets better, but it's not gone great.
It's completely in antithesis to what the government's saying. The government's being like, we want, you know, the UK to be a crypto-friendly place. And the FCA's basically being like, not on our watch. Like, come on, guys.
Yeah. Well, and it's, I mean, it is, and this is not, I worked in government for a long time. I sat on that side of the table and, you know, we are asking people who are not crypto native, may not even be really technical in their background, to understand something that is highly technical, that has the ability, you know, the potential to impact, you know, their entire population, to put some guardrails around it to protect consumers, right? Like, what is government's job at the end of the day? Like, it's their job to protect their citizens or residents, you know, from sort of physical harm, financial harm, whatever. Like, that's one of their main jobs. And so, and like, I don't disagree with that. Consumer protection is important and something that, you know, regulators should do. And we see this every day, like people do get scammed out of their crypto often. And so how do we protect them, right? And so, you know, we're sort of at this inflection point where all of a sudden, even when I started a blockchain, the best example, and sorry, this is so US centric, these comments, but I just think they help illustrate. And when I started a blockchain, there were 13 state bills or pieces of regulation that were created throughout all of 2021, 13. That's it. And they were like, you know, you can use, you know, crypto to pay your parking fines, right? They were like not super interesting regulatory schemes. 2022, there were almost 300.
Wow.
Right. So we are in the moment right now, like history is being made. And that permanent regulatory framework says two things. It says crypto is now forever, right? It is here to stay.
Right.
And it also says, there are rules the companies have to play by.
Right.
And, you know, when you zoom out for a second, when you look at the majors, right, the major companies in crypto, whether it's like, you know, the FTXs and Binances or like the blockchain and Coinbase or like throw in whoever you want. You could do like the Blockfire or the Kraken or whatever. You know, there are different approaches to regulation, right? There are the companies that are regulation first, right? Like blockchain, Coinbase, good examples. Like, we go in and ask for permission. We're sitting with regulators and like, trying to figure out what the regs should look like. And then there are the companies that are, you know, a bit sort of offshore in the sense that like they are operating, hoping that their business models sort of can continue uninterrupted by regulation.
Right.
And then we'll attempt to move it in the event that, you know, regulation starts to interfere.
Right.
It's called regulatory arbitrage, right? And so it is a different way of doing business. I can't, you know, I'm obviously, I prefer my model more. But so anyway, I think like, you know, we are going to see a lot more pain. Like, we're going to see a lot more regulations sort of be introduced around the world that we don't love. And it's going to be, you know, my job and my team's job and companies like ours to sort of, you know, work with regulators to get them to an acceptable level and understand that we're like, we're not going to love everything that happens, but we're going to love having permanent rules because a level playing field is good for everyone.
Right. I think one of the biggest problems that I see at the moment in the regulatory sort of like sphere is how what the delay is on thinking, right? So, you know, the ICO boom happened in 2017 and we only really got regulatory frameworks around the issuance of tokens, like basic ones in some jurisdictions in like 2019. And then like, DeFi is happening or has happened, and most of the regulatory frameworks, especially things like MiCA, just don't really understand, like haven't even envisaged the concept of DeFi happening, right? So like the idea of, you know, shared pools of liquidity in which people can sort of buy, sell, trade across it, and like how you would create a regulatory framework around a venue for exchange that's a decentralized contract, like all of that is probably another 3 years before like the regulators get their head around it, which isn't a short time for regulation and financial markets, but as a really long time for crypto, especially in terms of like teams trying to work out any kind of certainty in terms of what they should do next. So I think I do think that crypto still is in that phase. I know you're saying that it's sort of ask for permission. I think it is actually still in ask for forgiveness, as long as you're not doing egregious stuff like there's lines that are being drawn, but the lines are actually quite far into what I would call like clearly like high level money laundering risk. So the Tornado Cashes of the world, right? Like that, yeah, is clearly such a high money laundering risk, and the sort of the dual use of it for consumer privacy versus money laundering. I think, you know, sort of like as an aside, I think that privacy is really important, but I think the way in which that went has gone about it has meant that the regulator has basically been, look, we're seeing money from North Korea going through this, like we have to make some kind of action. So that is quite on the extreme end for companies that are like legitimately trying to create marketplaces for legitimate users and don't really understand how the regulatory framework works and are these high risk individuals we talked about. I think risk is important. Like if people weren't taking risks, then Uniswap wouldn't exist and Aave wouldn't exist and synthetics wouldn't exist. And these are the things that are actually showing us the bedrock tool set that will actually make the future of, you know, regulatory compliant or permanent, you know, regulatory framework compliant DeFi possible. They are the people that we need to be taking risks, because and so far I haven't actually seen regulators really crack down on stuff that is like where the team has clearly legitimately tried to do something like of value for the market. I may be wrong on that, and there may be some use case, there may be some examples that I haven't seen, but most like enforcement actions I've seen have been around things that are basically clearly scams and have been scams. And you know, the closest thing we got to there being like a mainstream L1 having an enforcement action on it was the EOS thing that went in New York. But I do think that people still like my you know sort of flag on this is that people should be following the Uber model still, where if you are delivering something of value to consumers, where consumers would shout and scream to the regulator that this needs to exist and it demonstrates value, it delivers value, like that should be the North Star, because ultimately that's what the regulator and the government is going to be looking at. Is this driving GDP growth? Is this driving consumer happiness? Like are we going to get votes for cracking down on it, or are we going to get like voted out because we crack down on it? And I think that's where it's really difficult right now with things like Terra Luna, that I think it's now so important that the industry leans in and continues to deliver things that are actually creating value for people. Otherwise, the regulatory needle is going to go too far. So I would actually argue risk is really important now. It's a risk on period, and like build, deliver, and show, demonstrate that value is here more than just scams and exploits and all this kind of stuff. Otherwise, the industry is going to be regulated out of existence.
You need to come with us to Brussels and help us educate here. You've got it figured out quite clearly. You clearly are thinking about this a lot more than most folks in crypto. You're absolutely right. And you know, it's create sticky products, and then you know, help regulators figure out what the right thing to do is to, you know, when to regulate. But you know, if somebody's using your products, you shouldn't be too worried about the government stepping in to regulate. You actually should embrace it, because it means that you'll be able to operate in a much more broader way. And everyone likes clear rules, right? Gray area is a hard place to build a business in.
Yeah, I think as long as the rules are built with the people, you know, I can't remember who said it. Actually, I think it was Bono, of all people to quote at the end of a podcast. But when Bono was going through his phase of like sort of Live 8 and stuff like that, someone from Africa said to him, Bono, when someone wants to have a haircut, it's a good idea to have him in the room at the time. And like it's a completely different context, but fundamentally the same thing. We need to make sure as an industry we're in the room as the rules are made, and not like just ignoring it. But it sounds like you're doing that. I'd love to come with you to Brussels. Thanks for the invite. You heard it here first. And it's been wonderful having you on the show. If there's to close out, if people want to sort of follow what you guys are doing, like get the first look at the super app you guys are building, like get involved with the blockchain.com community, where's the best place for them to get started?
Yeah, so you know we are in the digital ecosystem like everyone else. So App Blockchain, you can follow us on Twitter, you certainly can keep track of my more political musings with crypto, less product focused, but that's at Castleman, KASSELMAN. But all of our latest stuff is on crypto, and of course our CEO is super prolific in Twitter. One more Peter at One More Peter is his tagline, and he's much more active and keeps up with what's happening at the company and shares with everyone. So, Piers, thank you for having me. It was good to catch up, and I'm glad we finally did this and fun to chat about the business.
Thank you so much, Lane, and speak to you soon.
Utility, then you better call on these guys. I'm going radical, I'm going radish, I'm going radical, I'm going radish. Hyperspeed DeFi, never on a decline. Building the future, I feel like a savage.